They're all at IBM, and the result has been posted end of last year. So before that, I have about 5 minutes of material so that people can drift in slowly. So let me motivate the talk by talking the opposite, that for a long time, we tend to think coherence and privacy as very equivalent concepts. So there are many analogs between, say, a private secure key and entanglement. In fact, one of my most enjoyable talk that I have been to was given by Sandor Popescu on this result by him and Collins. It's 010782. So there, they make a very long list of analogs, why they are very similar concept between the two things. So for entanglement, the analog, the classical analog, is a private key. For coherent quantum communication, the classical analog is private communication. And then in quantum, when we have quantum system, the role of classical communication has a classical analog, that is public discussion. While the protocol teleportation has a clear classical analog, which is a one-time pad. Finally, entanglement purification, which means that you have n copies of a bipartite state, and you want to extract, and they're not good bipartite, they're noisy and so on, and you want to extract a small number of EPR pairs, and you go through a protocol. It's very, very analogous to privacy amplification. Oh, I see. I see what's wrong with the idea to save the top board. Okay, I put this high up. So this one has some place to go. So in fact, to make the connection between privacy and entanglement stronger, security proof for establishing a key using quantum key distribution, often the security proof itself often is a proof for entanglement purification. In the opposite direction, a lot of the techniques we know how to perform entanglement purification borrows from classical concept of privacy amplification. So there are lots and a lot of places where the two concepts are very, very related. So let me define a few quantities that we're interested in and talk. Say, given a state, rho, we can define the distillable entanglement. There are a few versions depending on whether you allow communication from one party to the other, or you allow two-way classical communication. So this is roughly speaking, I shouldn't use maximum, but I'll do it anyways, number of EPR pairs obtainable per copy of rho. And when I say when everything on the board, I assume that it's asymptotic in the sense that we have large number of copies of the resource. It's the state in this case. We allow extracting of the EPR pairs with a small vanishing error as the number of copies go higher and higher. So these are all asymptotic quantities. And likewise, you can define the number of secure key bits. Called key bits. Obtainable from per copy of rho. And we call it the distillable key for the state rho. So there are these two quantities for a state. And most of the talk today will concern channels, which is the more dynamic resources. So we are given a channel that we define Q of n as, very roughly speaking, the maximum number of qubits. You can transmit. Per use of n. Again, that assumes that we have large number of the channel we can use, and we just demand communication of the qubits with vanishing error as n goes larger and larger. And the quantity p of n is, again, the maximum, but this time it's the number of private classical bits one can transmit per use of n. And finally, the last quantity we're interested in is the classical capacity of the channel n. This is called the private capacity. This is the classical capacity. It's just the maximum number of bits you can transmit per use of n.
So what's the difference between a bit and a private bit?
There is a difference. Let me find an example. Take the classical channel, a noiseless classical channel, which means that we see the symmetric extension, but say I send my message to you, and Robert always receives a copy. Then this channel clearly has high classical capacity, but zero private capacity. Any further question on these quantities? So let me summarize what happened before 2003. I'm sure most of you probably know already. But before that, it's widely believed. That the amount of key you can distill is the same as the amount of entanglement, or at least if you can distill a key, you should be able to distill entanglement and vice versa. The analogy is so strong that it's actually kind of, everyone asks a question, is it actually the same rate, et cetera, et cetera. But it was unresolved for a long time, and it was believed that they are the same. And likewise, it's also believed that the quantum capacity of a channel is the same as the private capacity. Or again, at least they should be non-zero or zero together. So that was the belief. And of course, it's actually wrong. So in 2003, in a paper by Horodesky, three of them, and Oppenheim, maybe I should write their name, Horodesky and that is 0309110, they show that there exists a state role such that there is no entanglement, but there is a key that you can distill. So that's what they find. There is a nicer example that they find later on as a follow-up to this. And in particular, they find a density matrix that is supported in four dimensions on Ellis' side and four dimensions on Bob's side. This state is PPT. Can you see here? I'll put it up a little further.
I'll be able to see it in a few minutes when you put it up.
So this state is PPT. In fact, it's the partial transpose of the state is itself. So it is not distillable two-way. Even if you allow causal communication in both directions unlimited, you never get any entanglement out of this state. However, you can actually have a protocol that involves only forward communication from one party to the other. It's a symmetric state, so it doesn't matter which way. The number, the amount of key you can get per copy of the state is about 0.02. It's a solid number that they found. So it's really quite neat. Furthermore, this state is the choice state of a channel. So the same result carry on to a channel, that there exists a channel N such that there is no quantum capacity, but the private capacity is high. I think it's the same number you can get. So,
Debbie, when you're referring to the distilled entanglement and the capacity here, you mean in the asymptotic sense, like given n copies of rho,
yes,
what's the rate at which I can distill it?
Yes, everything asymptotic in the sense that large number of copies and also allowing a vanishing error. But I'll spare you guys for the capacity expression. There are five quantifiers there, so too late to do that today. We can do it if we have a 9:30 talk. So here, the question we want to ask is, so we see that they are qualitatively different. And the difference, because it is a small example, it's not very big. So the question is, are these two quantities similar? Our intuition is kind of broken here, but the question is, how broken is it? Or are they quantitatively can be very different? If they are always very similar, perhaps we should not worry too much about the difference. But if the difference can be very big, then we probably have to think a little harder if we are way off in our understanding of what's going on. So here is the answer. For any channel, you can derive an inequality, which says that the private capacity is never bigger than half of log the dimension of the input for the channel plus the quantum capacity. So if you look at this expression for a while, there are two extremes you can check. If the capacity is very high, so if the capacity is close to full amount, then the private capacity minus the quantum capacity, and it's always positive, so I can put an absolute sign on it, is always very small. So when things are clean and noiseless, yes, they are very strongly related concepts. To see this is, you just move the Qn to the other side. And the result is kind of silly because if Qn is very close to the maximum quantity, private capacity is at least as large as Qn. If you can send quantum data, it's private. So I should have mentioned that there is a relation here, that for all channels, there is a chain of inequalities here. So your private capacity is pretty high too. It has to be, but it can't be bigger than log d in. So they're both very close to log d in. That's why they are very similar to one another. On the other hand, if the quantum capacity is close to zero, then it gives a meaningful bound on the private capacity, which says that it cannot be bigger than half of the maximum quantity. So this gives a limit on the private capacity. And furthermore, so this is one, and answer number two is that we will see in this talk that there is a channel such that that inequality is asymptotically achieved. It has private capacity roughly half log d in, and quantum capacity is no bigger than one. And d is a parameter that we can blow. We can just make it as large as we want. So this saturates the inequality. Is there any question on the claim?
When was this proven?
September last year. it was actually pretty hard to prove this part. And we'll see part of the proof here.
So I'm just wondering, what's the connection with entanglement breaking channels? So can you find an entanglement breaking channel that still has private capacity?
No, I don't think you can.
OK, so these special channels which have no quantum capacity are not entanglement breaking channels?
Not at all. They are very, very quantum.
OK.
Yeah. we'll see the channel, so you see why they do what they do. Any further question on the statement before I show some detail? So then I'll take that board I want to keep. So for some reason, we pick the input dimension to be d squared. And if you like, d should be a power of 2. Allows certain things to be set a lot easier. So there are two kind of different input systems. So the total input dimension is d squared because there are two d-dimensional inputs to the channel. And what does it do? Let me put it this way. You can think about a random unitary from drawn according to Hammershaw if you want to. An easy way to think about it is a random Clifford gate is applied to the second register, followed by what we call a phase gate. This phase gate is diagonal. It takes the computation basis state, ij. Ij runs from 0 to d minus 1 in each register. It takes it to omega I times j, ij. And omega is a primitive d root of unity. Okay. So in other words, something random happens, and then there is a phase gate. This piece goes to Bob. So this is a system I call bk. This piece goes to Eve, the environment. So that is ek. And when we have a random Clifford here, we have to model it somehow. And in this channel, what actually happened is known to the receiver. So there is a piece that carries what B has happened. So to model that quantumly, we usually imagine that in the environment, there is a maximally entangled state. We usually just call it MES. Local dimension, DCH. So DC is the number of Clifford gates on D dimension. So that allows a random Clifford gate to be drawn and applied to the second register. And afterwards, Bob gets to know what it is. And so does Eve. Oops, this is ES. So the channel N takes A1, A2 to BK, BS. So that's the channel that we're looking at. There is a different channel. We call the complementary channel. Takes A1, A2 to EK, ES. So any question on what the channel does?
It's obvious that out of all the ways of dilating the channel N to the eavesdropper, this particular way of doing it gives the eavesdropper the most information. Because I presume to prove something about privacy, you'd want to say that, you know, it's that the proof doesn't depend on looking at this particular dilation. Because if I just implement a channel N, who knows how it's dilated?
That's right.
Aren't dilations equivalent up to a unitary on the environment? So
yeah, that's right. It should not depend on which dilation. And you're right that we pick this particular dilation because it allows us to analyze things easily.
So maybe, can you clarify that if this is really, I can think of this entire channel from A to BE as a unitary? Because, I mean, if it were like a unitary on the whole, then I agree that every other dilation is unitarily equivalent to this. But I guess the part
is it's isometric, right? Because
it's all
pure.
Yeah.
In the end, right? There's a pure state in the end.
Right. So you've basically made the classical stuff just quantum by throwing in a mechanism.
That's right.
Okay. Yeah.
But it is classical because it's symmetric between Bob and Eve.
Okay.
So there are a lot of nice properties about this channel. So let's see, where should I put it up? So this we already know, so we can erase. Which side is it supposed to go on? This way? Yeah. Ooh. So the first comment about this channel is that clearly the Carson capacity is at least log D, and it is actually log D. The way to achieve it is by putting the computation basis states in A1. Do anything you want to A2. The phase gate there preserve all the diagonal states. All the computation basis state would just be transmitted. Fine. So Bob can always read what I it is. So we can send D messages. The nice thing is that by construction, the private capacity is at least log D, and it is actually log D. The method is the same as putting the computation basis state on A1, and we'll see why if you choose half of a maximum entangled state to be fed into A2, then this I will be totally invisible to the eavesdropper. So let me state it here. Same input as above, put half of MES into A2. So,
I'm not so, I haven't internalized this definition of private capacity. Uh-huh. So I guess the private capacity is what the eavesdropper learns by his access to the environment. So I guess, why are you putting in a maximally entangled state into A2 here? Why is that?
So the private capacity is the maximum number of bits from, there are two ways to define it. One is how many bits you can send from Alice to Bob privately. Without
and privately is defined as, you know, if the eavesdropper gets the environment of the channel, then he is uncorrelated with those bits.
That's right.
Okay, so now where does the maximally entangled state come in then?
We'll see.
Okay.
So we'll show why these log D bits will be unreadable to the environment. Okay.
Is the other half of the maximally entangled state going to play some role, or would it be sufficient to say, feed the completely mixed state into A2?
Depends on whether you worry who is holding the other half. As long as it's not with Eve, it's fine. But the only way I know that it's not with Eve is that it should be with Alice. So I personally prefer Alice be holding it. I mean, she create this half, this maximum entangled state locally and fit half into it. That's how you should think about it. So so just imagine from that first part, maybe I'll draw a little bit on it. So bring it down. Like this machine. So if there is a half of a maximum entangled state here, then what we're going to do is to use the fact that our state here, that the transpose trick, is that if you start with a maximum entangled state and you apply an operation, say A on half of the maximally entangled state, then the final state here is equal to the state coming from applying the transpose of A on the other half. So it's an equation on the final state after applying an operation on half of a maximum entangled state. So here, what we're going to do is to take the conditioned version of that trick to see that we have a conditional gate from BS onto EK. So we can apply a conditional gate from here into this half instead, by putting the transpose onto V. And then we do the same for this controlled gate. So that gives us a circuit like this.
Back the white
Okay. My department chair said that the student get very excited when you use a colored chalk. we have the eye here. This is A1. We have A2. This is half of a maximum integral state now. So Alice is holding this, so I call this AS. This goes into the channel and out to EK. And then there is this piece that is BS. And this is the part that controls that random Clifford. So now, instead of it applying to A2, now it goes to AS with a transpose there. The transpose of a Clifford gate is still a Clifford gate. So, and in the original drawing, there is a phase gate between these two pieces. Now, that phase gate, you can think about it as a conditional gate. If this is I, you apply a generalized signal C to the power I onto the other piece. So this, if the state coming into it is J, Z is 1 omega, omega squared, etc. Omega D minus 1. So you can think about the control phase gate that way. So you can likewise take this control phase and apply to the other half. And it goes before the Clifford gate. So we have a sigma z transpose to the power I here. But it's diagonal, so the transpose does not do anything. Okay? So that's what happened after Alice plug in half of a maximum entangled state here and an I here. And that's the final state. Now, this is a little hard to read, but this is ES. Is it obvious that Eve has no information?
She has two halves of two maximally entangled.
Exactly. So I don't need to draw the unwinded diagram. So shall I draw the other diagram or not? Is it obvious enough? I'll do it. Just.
Debbie, the reason the order got reversed is because I can think of it as controlled on ES and A1, and when I take the transpose, the order reverses under.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Okay. Or if you just apply the transpose, strike twice. Naturally, you first move that one, and then you move the next one, and it has to go before. Because the transpose trick only applies to a maximum entangled state.
I see.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if we unwind that, it's quite a nice, clean diagram. That has the I going to BK, and now this time, this gate goes down here to AS. This is the AS here. This piece initially is A2, then it becomes EK. This is BS, this is ES. And that's actually the final state if you wire the things, like drawing it like a planar graph or something. And this is, as Gus said, it's clear that this operation here has no temporal order compared to what Eve has received. So there's nothing Eve can learn about I. So. So the remaining part is to show why this channel has very little quantum capacity. It's actually where most of the work goes into. I mean, this we know how to construct it to do the right job. The intuition is the following. I should delete that bit that I dropped in. So this is our channel. The intuition is quite simple, too. You want to send something from A1 to BK. If you have a computational basis state, almost nothing happened. But if you want to send anything else, there is a control phase gate between them. Now, if you have the way to make sure that there is no entanglement between the two pieces is to be sure that this is a definite computation basis state. then there is a unitary happen here, and you're fine. The problem, the way we construct it, is that there is no way Alice can stick in anything here up front before knowing what V is, such that this come out to be a computation basis thing. And if V is random enough, there's no way Alice can code. So that's the intuition. Now, the proof is a different matter. Because we have to look at n copies of this channel, look at all possible way to feed in an input on n copies of A1 and A2, and show that nothing can get through. How do we do it? Is there one behind the arguments? So before that, I should mention how we quantify quantum capacity. So I have skipped writing down the definition of quantum capacity, but then it happens to have a very nice expression. Nice in the sense you can at least write it down. It is in terms of what we call the coherent information on n copies of the channel. You calculate that expression, divide by n, take n, goes to infinity. And that gives you the capacity. And what is the coherent information? So Q1 of, say, any other channel n is defined to be maximum over any input state. So in our example, A has A1 and A2. And eventually we want to stick in a large n-copy channel there. We have the entropy of the output on both sides. So this is SB minus the entropy on the environment for the same input. So this is SE. So that's what we call the one-shot coherent information of the channel, and it has a maximization over the input. If you do it for n copies of the channel, divide by n, you get the capacity. And this thing is not known to be decidable. In fact, one of the major open problems is that if you give me a channel n, can we decide whether it has zero capacity or not? And we do not know how to do it, because it can stay zero for many, many copies, and suddenly it jumps to something on zero. We can't work that out. So we don't really know how to deal with these things in general. But this channel has been constructed so that we can prove an upper bound on the capacity. So first, we have a lemma. What is the optimal input for n copy? First, when we have n copies of the channel, we have n copies of A1 and n copies of A2. The claim is that the optimal state is a classical register, is the classical state on the n copies of A1. I should say that the vector x represents x1, x2 through xn. Each xi can be in 0, 1 through d minus 1. So that's one thing we know about the optimal state. The first input is always classical. Furthermore, this piece here, for every value of the vector x, can be chosen to be pure. Is A2 n copies can be chosen pure. Okay.
information that I assume the N here is a general channel, not necessarily one.
That's right. I should have used a different symbol.
No, that's okay. But I'm just trying to sort of see intuitively how I would expect that to quantify the quantum.
Ah, yes. And
so how should I think of phi A?
So this is the input. In a sense, they always say that this quantifies how much Bob gets, and this quantifies how much Eve gets. So, and the capacity, the quantum capacity, is how much better off Bob is compared to Eve.
But if I imagine a noiseless channel such that every pure state comes out at Bob's end and Eve gets nothing, then the entropy on Bob's side is zero. And so that's not high. And it's just that you don't get a large negative penalty because.
So for the noiseless state, for the noiseless channel, this is always a pure state. However you choose the input, OK? So this is always zero.
I see.
Then my optimal input is actually the maximally mixed, the state that would give the maximally mixed output.
Why is the output of Eve's end always pure?
Because the only way your channel is noiseless is that, so the isometric accession, there's an input, is split between Bob and Eve. Mm-hmm. And why is it pure? If you look at the choice state for the noiseless channel, it has to be the maximum entangled state.
Okay.
If this is maximum entangled, this cannot have anything to do with the reference and Eve. So it has to be pure.
Okay. So that would explain why the second term is zero. And then shouldn't I expect for every phi I put in to just get it coming out the other side at Bob's end so that.
That's exactly the state I'll put in.
Okay.
It's half of the maximum entangled state I'll put in.
I see.
So that
phi,
will max.
Phi A could be a mixed state. It's not a pure state in this context. That
yes, that's right. That's right. It's any input states. I should have mentioned that.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay.
Of course, if your channel is funny, that it does not give you a maximum mixed state on the output, then it is whatever maximally mixed state it can output.
Is it actually the same thing as asking if you put a maximally entangled state in, how much the entanglement ends up with Bob and how much with Eve?
Yep, that's one other way you can interpret the expression. Of course, there are channels in which the maximum capacity is achieved by something that is not maximum entangled in the input. Yeah. The choice state need not be the most entangled state between Alice and Bob. And this maximization should be taken over the most general density matrix on the entire input that you're considering. And that explains why it takes a proof for us, because we have to analyze the most general input to the two N inputs. And so the first step here is to say that actually we know something about it, because it is a classical register on the first pieces. And then the second, all the second piece together is a single pure state for each value of x. So that's what we know. And I want to give a very quick proof of that. Let's see. So that is 10 minutes fast, right, the clock?
Yeah.
Okay.
We have about 15 minutes, plus or minus.
Which way does this go? So we have this diagram that I probably should draw once. It looks kind of silly to just draw the channel n times. So we have many copies of the channel. Now, suppose we feed in the input, tau A1n, A2n, that is optimal. If you pick a finite value of n, that maximization is over a compact set, so you can actually have an optimal input. You stick it in there. So this is the output that we're going to evaluate, the coherent information. That's n tensor n tau for Bob, and is the complementary channel for Eve. Now, the trick we use to get the result is that we consider, after evaluation of the coherent information, what if we take, we look at Bob's state, quantum state, and we apply the completely defacing gate, the defacing channel on it. So P of rho equals to a sum over I equals to 0 to d minus 1, average over d values, zi, rho zi dagger. So this operation just take away all the off-diagonal element for the density matrix. Now, if we apply the complete defacing gate for all the system that Bob is having, then what happened is that because this gate, this channel is, we know that it has a property that it cannot decrease entropy for the input. So we know that the entropy on P tensor N, I skip the identity part, on the output, on tau, is always at least as big as without the defacing gate, the defacing channel. Because these are what we call unital channels. Now, the second thing to note is that, I forgot the phase gate here. The defacing map actually commute with the channel. These are all diagonal operations. So you can push it back to before the channel has acted. So this actually equals to the entropy of the channel acting on the defacing gate acting on tau. Okay. So meanwhile, the defacing gate cannot change anything on Eve side. So the entropy there is preserved. So S on n hat tensor n it just has no effect on Eve. So this is the, so I'll put the front one behind. So our the coherent information we try to optimize is equal to is equal to the difference here. And we can only make it bigger when we insert the defacing gate, the defacing channel onto the optimal input. And it doesn't affect the second term. So so we can just add it in. So it means that if tau is already optimal, P tensor N acting on tau is also optimal. If tau is optimal. Because you can't decrease the coherent information. So it means that the optimal state always have the form, can always be taken to be the form. As if the defacing channel has happened to all the A1s. When we commute it back, when we commute the defacing channel back to before the gate, before the channel, it acts on A1. Okay. So that's why we know that it has this form. To show that these are actually pure, it takes a little more work. It is a very funny convexity argument that we use, but it's not the regular convexity argument. So I will not show that part. You can talk to me after that. of the detect. So from there, it's far from being done because we still have to deal with what happened when we stick this piece into the other registers. So the next step is that we actually try to go and evaluate what the expression is. So we have the optimal state of that form. We stick it in to the channel. Now, if you look at what happened to Bob, he is actually only receiving this classical register X. The quantum part goes to Eve. So that's all he got. So his entropy is H of the probability distribution over all the X registers, okay. Plus the piece that he got, which is log BC, just a random value of the Clifford gate that it really shouldn't be there, but technically it's part of Bob's output, so we put that as the entropy term. And then we look at what happened to the complementary channel on each side. A1N, A2N. So this is the entropy on the output state, on all the output state that Eve has, on the quantum part, the EK part, all N of them. Given the other piece plus the entropy of the other piece is the chain rule that I have used, that Eve has two pieces per channel. So we collected all the terms here that comes from saying which V has been applied, and then what is her entropy on the other quantum part conditioned on the value of V. So that gives us S of EKN given ESN plus the same log DC term. They should cancel out. This random piece of information should not add to the coherent information. So when you look at the difference, it's only this piece minus this one will give us the quantum capacity. So here is another intuition that we have used, that if for all values of V, this thing, so what Eve got is actually a bunch of sigma Zs acting on this state. So this is the state, so I've written this as a pure state. And after n uses of channel, you have n copies of the V, so I should put a hat there, acting on the pure state followed by the phase that depends on X. So that's what if we get conditioned on the fact that it is the X term and the fact that V has happened. So this is what she gets. We want to find out what is the entropy of these things when you mix it up over all values of X, but for one value of V. That will give us the entropy here. So this ensemble over X, if this ensemble is an orthogonal set of state, If that's the case, then S of EKN given ESN will also be H of PX. So if for different values of X, if C is a distinguishable state, she knows as much as Bob because she can find out what X is herself. So Bob will get no advantage over her, and the capacity will be zero. So that's our intuition here. The truth is that these states are not orthogonal, but they are very close to.
Kathy, can you clarify the V vector notation just means V copies on?
Yeah, sorry. We have n copies of that channel.
Yeah.
So NIID draws of these Vs has happened. Yeah.
Okay.
So for every realization of that n values, we have a bunch of state labeled by X. And the question is, how much Eve actually learn about X from those states? And if she learned the full amount, then the capacity is zero. So how much can she learn? I'll just try to write down here, because it's close to the time I have for the talk. Average over V, when you look at this quantity, can I call this state inside rho E X V? That's what it is. Trace rho E X V and trace E Y V. So there are two different values of X. It's no bigger than 1 over D minus 1. The Hamming distance between X and Y, which is the number of entries, there are n of them, at which the vector of X and the vector of Y differ. So it's small. And we know how small it is. But it is not zero. So I want to just say that this quickly will give us a bound, which doesn't quite work. It gives us the Rennie 2 entropy of Eve state, given that optimal input. Now we have a single value of V, but we average over the X, which is one term. This term here for Eve, is a sum over all possible values of V. And then we look at her state after it's averaged over the X's. So this is one term, one V term in her entropy, except we actually end up having a very quick relation on the Rennie 2 entropy. This thing is at least as big as the Rennie 2 entropy of Px minus n. This is what we get. I'll raise it a little bit. Does it go up at all? No. This is the last one. If we don't have the 2 here, that's what we want. Because then we look at the difference between what Bob has and what Eve has. Then the difference is at most n, but there are n users of the channel. So we divide that by n, we're done. But we get the wrong entropy. It's not the Rennie 2 entropy that we want to use. So to solve that problem, there was a few technical steps that we did. We double block. We look at m copies of this particular state. We look at the typical values of that m copies of the length n random variables. And then we do the rest. So all the epsilon delta come out to be correct, and we get our result. That's what happened. So I think, it's a good point to stop, because I shouldn't start on any of that epsilon delta business. So.
Thanks, Deb. Any questions?
I'm a little bit confused.
confused on that last sentence you just said there, because you're kind of double blocking it, so you're taking blocks of M and taking many blocks, many copies of these M blocks.
Yeah.
But then wouldn't you have like a factor of M lying around here that you're not, that you're losing?
Not quite, because we look at that M copy state, and there for any epsilon you choose, there exists an M, so that the state with only the typical terms versus the state with all the terms has trace distance epsilon. Then we apply fairness inequality on the entropy, which picks up a term which has an M and an N in the front, but it also has an epsilon there that disappears. So the M doesn't appear anywhere.
What do we know about the single-shot version of these questions? So I'm not interested in the asymptotic capacity, but for instance, the, I don't know, like maybe the zero-error capacities. Can we also talk about the distinction?
We can, but we actually have a single-shot result here. Because the asymptotic quantum capacity is an upper bound on the single-shot. On the single shot case. And that further is an upper bound on the zero error capacity. This asymptotic QN that we're looking at is the most generous quantum capacity we can come up with. And even that one is no bigger than one. And our.
And I guess it's obvious that if you just do a single version of this, the private capacity is.
It's achievable on single shot.
Right.
So.
So the quantum the quantum capacity is less than one. It seems like a weird coincidence.
It is 0.69 something.
Oh, okay. So
it is the Euler's constant.
What's Euler's constant?
It's in the paper.
Oh, okay.
There is an integral defining it.
Okay, so it's not one. It's like points. It's well less. Okay.
Let me be careful there. We calculated that based on the V chosen according to the Hall measure. There is no reason why it should change when we place that by the Clifford gate. But we haven't checked that. So to show that when we want to have a lower bound on the quantum capacity, we have to find a code that will achieve that. And that takes another long proof. It's actually one of the longest proofs in the paper as an appendix. And it was
proved. Sorry, what are you trying to find?
So we have an upper bound on the quantum capacity. That is no bigger than one.
Yeah.
But now you ask, do we actually know anything about the quantum capacity?
Yeah.
We know that there is a code that will allow us to send about 0.69 bits per use.
Okay.
And that assumes B is distributed according to the Hall measure. And what happened when we replace it by the Clifford gate, we kind of say that we should calculate that in the paper, and no one did.
Okay. But even for the Clifford problem, you still know it's less than, or the random Clifford gate, you still know it's less than one, right? You just don't know that it's less than 0.6 or whatever.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Is there any reason to believe that like some other more complicated construction could reduce that quantum capacity even lower? I mean, this is probably, you know, beating a dead horse here now that we've gotten it down to a constant. Just out of curiosity. It seems weird that you have this small number sticking around.
So you're absolutely right. It will be interesting to see an example in which the quantum capacity actually is zero.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to prove anything about the quantum capacity. I mean, the whole point about torturing you for 20 minutes showing you the upper bound is to demonstrate the fact that it's generally really hard to conclude anything about the quantum capacity. Here, we make the channel work so that we can claim something. The challenge is to bound the input. And the only thing we know that has zero capacity is either the channel is PPT or is symmetric with respect to Eve and Bob. The second type of zero capacity channel has no private capacity. So you can only look at the PPT channels. In those cases, there are first very few PPT states and PPT channels that are known. And second, they are fairly noisy. So the capacities are fairly low for the private capacity. That's what happened with the example with the 0.02 qubits. So that's kind of the difficulty in the construction. Yeah. I'm not sure if there's a more fundamental reason why we cannot push it down to zero. Actually,
even just like epsilon for any given epsilon. I mean, it doesn't have to be precisely zero.
Yeah, those, if you can find those channels, it will be interesting, because that, again, pushes us to ask, do we ever know whether a channel has zero capacity or not? I mean, that is a dreadfully difficult problem. We just don't know. We don't know what channels have zero capacities. Yeah, let alone very small capacity. I should mention a small thing, that the same channel, but with a different Clifford acting on A1, also conditioned on some maximum entangled state, if you have the two Clifford there, that channel was used 4 years ago by Graham and John in showing that you can have channels that have very large assisted capacities. If you give back communication for free, you give entanglement for free, or you give symmetric side channel for free, then those channels has very high capacity on the order logging. And the causal capacity is no bigger than 2. So everything is small. Here, we just kind of minimally open, remove some of the randomness, and suddenly the private capacity jump. The causal and the private capacity just jump to the high value, and the quantum capacity stays low. And again, that is another very unusual case in which you can prove something about the causal capacity, because we have another one of these regularized expression about the whole level quantity. So it's generally very hard to prove anything unless you have a good construction on the channel. And that's why we kind of reuse half of it here. Yeah.
So this convexity question is complicated, or?
It should be discussed offline. I have to read about it and think about it again last night to be sure that I know how to answer if anyone asks. Yeah, we worried for 3 days that it will break the idea. Yeah, but it actually worked.
The example they gave from Hardeck and Oppenheim of this PPT state. So on the state side, you know, there's an example of a state that has non-zero entanglement formation, but zero distillable entanglement by virtue of being a PPT state. And I presume that that means on the channel side of things, I could also think of it as a channel that requires, you know, to simulate that channel in terms of, say, one-bit noiseless channel, its cost of simulation is higher than what it can simulate itself. Is that, have I got that right? Is there sort of an analog of the gap between the entanglement of distillation, entanglement formation, the formation for channels?
I guess so. Because you can, what you can do is to, so if you're given the channel, you create the choice state of the channel.
Right.
And that state has non-zero entanglement of formation. Now, I suppose that probably says something about the entanglement cost. I mean, the two quantities, we never know whether they are always equal or not. But supposedly, if they are equal, then it would take some non-negligible amount of entanglement to simulate.
So does your example give a larger,
it's
a choice
huge.
State and I find a PPT state, I get an example where there's a particularly large gap between the formation and the distillation?
Yeah.
Okay.
This state has very high assisted capacity. Because even with the randomization on the first piece, the back assisted capacity is like log D over 3 or something, 2 over 3 log D, or I forgot the exact calculation. So it is a large fraction times log D worth of entanglement that you can create out of using back communication, or a lot of resources that does not give you entanglement. So this state has humongous amount of entanglement that you can extract given the right assisting resource. So it has a lot of entanglement that you have to put in upfront. Yeah. I think the two-way assisted capacity most likely is actually log D itself. I have to double check it for a few minutes, but I think it's actually log D. It's fairly easy to see. Because, again, Alice put in half of a maximum entanglement state on A2. Bob guessed the answer. What is V? tells Alice about it. Alice go and undo it on her half of the maximum entanglement state, so nothing happened on A2. And I think it somehow gives you a way to establish entanglement between Alice in A1. Like, if Alice also sent in half of her maximum entanglement state into A1, then she and Bob will share log DE bits. That's right. And after that, she can teleport. Yeah. So up to, at worst, a factor of half or so, the two-way assisted capacity of this is locked in. So you need at least that much entanglement, because the cost of communication cannot give you entanglement. So.
There are no other questions? Let's thank Debbie again.